Good afternoon. This is Nevin Campanella welcoming you to the BBS production of Woodland Star, your net radio source for entertainment and coincidental enlightenment. Isn't that neat, coincidental enlightenment? I don't know. Maybe I'm going to get coincidentally enlightened. I got to tell you, starting the series on Jane Roberts and Seth, I think I have become somewhat more knowledgeable, at least in terms of what really happened and what Seth really was saying. There's a lot of, fashionable cliches that run around the metaphysical network, such as create your own reality. Yeah, create your own reality. What the hell does that mean? The simple truth is that's probably 99% of what Seth was trying to get across to everyone. But there's a lot of other insights going on. There really is some, quote, enlightenment. For instance, one of the students of Jane Roberts was Andy Hughes. Now, I shouldn't say was, because I really don't know if the man is still alive or not. And I did put him in the past tense, but according to Seth, there is no past tense. Anyway, one of the things that was interesting about Andy is he took a lot of notes when Jane would be going through the, I don't know what to call it, seance, channeling, whatever. There's one interesting passage from his notes. I'm just going to simply quote it to you. This is now supposedly directly from Seth to Jane to her ESP class. Quote, using your free will, you have made physical reality into something quite different than what was intended. You have allowed the ego to become overly developed and specialized. You are here to work out problems and challenges, but you are always to be aware of your own inner reality and of your non-physical existence. To a large extent, you have lost contact with this. You have focused so strongly upon physical reality that it became the only reality that you know. End quote. Wow. I mean, think about it. What is he saying? He's saying that what we experience in the here and now, right now, all of you, bills to pay, losing your mortgage, fights with your family, et cetera, world wars, and so on and so forth. It's a mistake. Can you believe it? That is what that's what that comes down to. It's different than what was intended. This happened because our ego became overly developed. We weren't supposed to be like this. And what do I mean like this? What I mean is that we actually are lost in physical reality, and we have no real sense of our own inner reality. It's completely lost to us. Why does the ego do this? What is it about the ego that produced such a monumental error in existence? Well, I don't think it's going to surprise anyone to hear that the ego is a trap for everyone, simply because the ego separates you from everything else. It's that simple. And your ego will keep you separated from everything else. That's its job. That's its function, to give you the sense of separateness. Now, along with that sense of separateness, and I think I have to jump into old Freud for a second here. Freud knew that there was something about humans that was sort of an innate capacity to protect, to hold together their sense of self. The problem is that what they started holding together somewhere in time, Seth's time, was the ego. And the ego will do whatever it can to protect the self from everything, including itself and any changes. Ego does not like change, none at all. So how can you create a reality if you've got something about you that is literally saying, nope, nothing's going to change, so therefore nothing is going to get created? Imagine this whole process of physical reality and how tied we are to it was nothing more than a mistake, an error in existence. I guess you'd have to call it a big oops. Oops, sorry. Well, can we get out of it? Yeah, according to Seth, we can. Although many of us really don't want to, because like I said before, the ego is protecting the self from any kind of change. Now, Andy Hughes has a number of different kinds of quotes and comments, and some of them you've heard before. Some of them you haven't. It's not written out as nicely as Jane Roberts' work is written out. But there are some very specific things about it that kind of make you go, wow. One of them is that in Andy's notes, he points out that Seth states that he was sent here. He was sent here. So you got to ask yourself, sent here by whom? What is out there in the grand land of existence itself that has some sort of controlling influence over the realities that do exist? Seth also points out that he's not the only one and that a number of others have been sent here. Now, they were sent here to help us out of the dilemma. Hell of a dilemma, isn't it? I mean, we have, I don't know, how many hundreds of thousands of years of existence in physical reality. And somehow we're supposed to untangle this? I wonder. Let's give a little example here of some of the things, other things out of Andy's notes. Quote, when you kill a man, you believe you kill him forever. Murder is a crime that must then be dealt with. Death, however, does not exist in those terms. In the dawn of physical existence, men knew that death was merely a change of form. Get that? In the dawn of physical existence. You know, if you use the term dawn, you are in fact suggesting an element of time. Now granted, Seth says that our time, as we use it, is an illusion. But it is a marker, and it gives us a way of communicating from one thing to another thing. So apparently there is a dawn or point of creation itself of physical existence. Not of all of existence. Keep in mind, I'm using the word physical existence here. There is a point of creation of physical existence. And at that point, at that beginning, men knew that death was merely a change of form. What would it have been like to have be able to remember back to that beginning essence. Something else, huh? Quote, if you don't like the state of your world, it is you yourself that must change, individually and en masse. This is the only way that change will be effected. You know, Gandhi said something very similar. Become the change you want to see. Was Gandhi someone that was sent? I suspect that the people who have been sent do know that they were sent here. They know that there was a mission of sorts. I get a kick out of all the metaphysical types who want to talk about reincarnation, and it seems like everybody's that you meet on the net is the reincarnation of always very famous people. You rarely run into someone who says, well, I'm the reincarnation of the bottom of the barrel of society. I was living as a drunk, killed a lot of people, murdered many, 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 and was really a no good person. And I seem to keep reincarnating that way until eventually I elevated myself a little bit. Very rarely. Well, actually never. I've never met anybody who discusses their reincarnation in those terms. Oh no, of course not. With women, you know, it's always some reincarnation from some high priestess. With men, you know, you the emperor of Rome and so on and so forth. How interesting. The problem is that many of these people who want you to believe a particular thing about them in terms of reincarnation are plain bullshitting. Yeah, that's it. They're just plain bullshitting you. That's the unfortunate part, because there really is a reincarnational aspect to them. But like everyone else lately, they kind of jump on the metaphysical bandwagon. I like to refer to it as the organized spirituality. You know, you're really not complete unless you can divulge your reincarnational self. And of course, it's always going to be somebody really important. It's never going to be something like, well, yeah, I was a servant of a lower-level lord of some sort in England back in 1520. No, you're not going to hear anything like that. I think it's kind of good to review a little bit the Seth material, what I've covered so far. I think most interesting to me in terms of review is that Seth states that every action or event has many probable renditions, and each one is actualized in some other system of reality. Well, that's rather an amazing statement, because what it's saying is every thought, every action, no matter what it is, goes on at an infinite level. He suggests that there are four particular states of existence that we in this existence are composed of and actually know about. It's that there's the physical state, we're all aware of that, you know, we can see our bodies, we can see the toys around us and so on and so forth. There's also the dream state, and we all know about that. We go to sleep at night, we have a dream, and then we kind of reject the whole thing in the morning as, oh well, it's just a dream. But then he talks about two others, and to tell you the truth, I can't make heads or tails out of them. One of them a little bit I can, and that's called the electrical state. I can almost understand that. But the fourth one, the antimatter state, I think that's beyond just about everyone who has reviewed the Seth material. And of course, he also suggested that reincarnation itself is kind of like a must. And here again we go with this this imperative that there's something in control. You have to reincarnate at least twice, because the whole process of this existence is to understand the reality of being a father and the reality of motherhood. And so, of course, it's implied that each of us must experience the birth process. Well, when you think about this type of material in the world today, you got to wonder what happened to the Seth process itself. In other words, Seth comes on the scene,
December 3rd, 1963, via the process of the Ouija board,
hangs around for 21 years. Many of these wonderful books are produced, but the question I want to ask is, has the world changed one iota since that happened? I mean, have we actually moved towards a better understanding of our existence? Are we all starting to let go of that ego?
You know, it was a free will
which allowed us to make up physical reality. But I don't see that our free will is in any way, shape, or form moving us away from that prisoner, or I should say warden, called the ego. We are the prisoner of the ego. The ego is the warden. I don't see that we've moved any further away from it. Well, there are also some rather amazing insights about what happened over time from the Seth material. For instance, there are, as examples given by Seth, probable universes in which the dinosaurs are still alive, and probable universes in which Christianity did not develop. Oh! Geez, I think in terms of dinosaurs still alive and Christianity not having developed, and I say to myself, hey, you know, that doesn't sound too bad. And I guess because I'm also saying to anyone who's listening to this that many of the horrors that we experience, I think it must be something like a social ego. I think I'm going to have to call it a religion. The ego of religion itself has caused many hardships on this planet. Many, many, many hardships. So Seth also says that we do have many counterparts within all the probable renditions of the universe. And they don't all have the same name. And nor do they all have the same occupation or the same personal relationships. If you're trying to put it all together, what Seth is saying is that each of us is a gestalt consisting of the inner self plus all the outer egos and reincarnational selves. That means including all the probable selves and all renditions of the universe. That's what the entire self is. Can you feel it? I sure as hell can't. I don't. Simple fact is I feel as separate from things as everyone else does. I'm probably just one of the few people that's willing to admit it. Do I believe the Seth material? Wow. Just by the process of using the term belief kind of puts me on a defensive, because I don't really want to believe in anything, because the minute that I start using the term believe, it starts putting me in a pigeonhole. I think the Seth material warrants a lot of investigation. Now, I can use the term belief in the sense that, do I believe that Seth is an entity that was somehow channeled through a gal named Jane Roberts? Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I've been through the Seth material, and I'm telling you, there is no way that gal could have made up this stuff. There is no way. While Jane Roberts was a talented, creative woman, many of the things that she spoke of, she didn't have any background in, especially in some of the things concerning quantum mechanics. She just plain didn't have the background. Well, Seth does talk about the God concept, and I think that's a good place to start focusing today's show, at least begin there. Because one of the terms that he uses also gets bantered about, you know, let's be politically correct, and instead of saying God, we'll say, quote, all that is, end quote. Oh, another fashionable, metaphysical, spiritual thing to say. What the hell does it mean? Most of the metaphysical people propping themselves up out there, trying to let you believe or get you to believe that they know what is going on, love to use the phrase, all that is. They don't have a goddamn bit of understanding as to what that really means. No, they don't. Go check the websites. You don't believe me? Go look at it yourself if you can read. Yeah, can you read? What you're going to find out, folks, is that these people out there, organized spirituality, the leaders of organized spirituality, are trying to get you to maintain your ego, not get rid of it. That's why they're trying to sell you something. Let's get back to all that is. I keep getting on this damn soapbox. Okay, all that is. Pantheism. That's what that is. Isn't that a fun word, pantheism? It's a gestalt of all of existence. You've got to be careful here. Pantheism often gets confused with another term called panentheism. Very subtle difference there. The only change, okay, is that pantheism and panentheism, there's just a little E-N between N and the T-H, but it makes it very different. So you got to be really careful of which term you're really referring to is. Now, what Seth is saying when he says all that God, that there is a God, what he's saying is God is all that is in terms of pantheism, and that is a view that everything is of an all-encompassing, abstract God. By the way, folks, that comes straight out of Wikipedia. That the universe and God are equivalent. In other words, there isn't this God guy somewhere out there above all existences in a big flowing robe that you must pay homage to or worship or anything else. No. When Seth says all that is, he really means all that is, including your plastic cigarette lighter or aliens of some sort living in a different type of dimension. You know, what do they like to talk about, the 8th, 9th, 10th level of dimension? Pantheism means an all-encompassing, abstract God. There's no one to bow down to. You don't worship anything. It's simply everything that is. Now, the trick, of course, comes in when people want to say, yeah, but where did it start? There is no starting point. That's the best I can give you. There is no starting point. If you try to go into those realms, at least with our language structure, it's a losing proposition. You're just going to go around in a circle. About the best I can offer from a person that has read a lot of this Seth material is that God as a concept really is all that is in terms and in the terms of pantheism. Okay? Now, How is that really different than pan and theism? Get the N in there? Pan and theism. By the way, both words are come from the Greek language. And essentially, they mean all. But pan and theism is a belief system which suggests that one God interpenetrates every part of nature and timelessly extends beyond as well. Now, what is that saying is that there is, in fact, a force, an entity, that is beyond the level of the material universe. There is a God of sorts that is above and beyond everything else and can actually be distinguished from everything we understand and know. That is where many religions form. It was as if people just really had a hard time grasping hold of a concept of an abstract God, and they just kind of like really insisted that there had to be something beyond what we see and understand. And panentheism developed as that process, but they did not want to put a flowing robe on the God entity. So they simply said, well, God does exist, but he exists as part of everything and at the same time also separate from everything. So panentheism means that God is the supreme affect and effect of the universe. In other words, God, the separate thing, pushed everything else forward. Granted, both terms are a little bit difficult to really digest and understand. And for the purposes of what I'm talking about on this show, the Seth material, Seth is talking about pantheism and not panentheism. Seth is saying the God that he knows is simply abstract concept of everything. It does get confusing, and you have to keep those two words separate. Now, another word that Seth uses is gestalt, and unfortunately, this term really got hammered over time. It's a German term. And it really kind of got twisted. And I'm going to get to that in a second here. Well, what does gestalt mean? Well, it's a collection of physical, biological, psychological, or symbolic entities that creates a unified concept, okay? It's a pattern, which is, now listen to this, which is greater than the sum of its parts, end quote. And you're going to find that a lot. You're going to find that little quote there, a pattern which is greater than the sum of its parts. You're going to find that a lot in definitions and in all over the net. Unfortunately, there's a little part of that that really is not quite correct. And that is a term greater than the sum of its parts, greater than. That's where the problem comes in. Gestalt does not mean that the result is greater than the sum of its parts. No. It is simply different than the sum of its parts. And that word should have been, historically, it should have been different, but it came out greater, and that might have something to do in translation between German and English. I'm really not sure. But what I'm telling you is that the term gestalt, it does not mean greater than the sum of its parts. It means something that is different than the sum of its parts. And why is it so important? Because the term greater implies a hierarchy of some sort. And there isn't any. It's simply different than the sum of its parts. Well, how can we how can we look at that in some sort of layman's terms? I mean, Seth uses the term gestalt a lot. Well, I like the concept of using the car when we talk about gestalt, because it's a it lends an immediate visual image. You know, I say car, and everybody has a wham. Okay, you know, it's my car. Cars I've seen on the street. It's a Corvette. It's whatever. All right, let's take a look at it. There is a certain amount of material that when you put it together, it makes a machine that moves on wheels under the control of a driver. What is that? What is that machine that moves under the control? We have all these parts, okay? And you put them all together via Detroit, and you get this machine that moves around, this fantastic thing that can take you where you want to go. Now, the gestalt comes in the aspect of a car may be many different things. It is not simply the sum of all its parts. It could be a status symbol. It could be a means of expressing our creative self. So when you take the term gestalt and apply it to this pile of material that makes up this machine that moves around, call the car, the gestalt is in fact different than the sum of all its parts. A status symbol is certainly different than the sum of all the parts that is simply a machine that moves about under the control of a driver. That's the gestalt aspect. When you start using terms like automobile, car, so on and so forth, these really are different than saying a machine that moves around under the control of a driver. That's the gestalt aspect. Matter of fact, some people have suggested that the size of a man's car is a reflection of his own sense of sexuality. You know, the bigger the car, the bigger the bang. Well, I don't know. Anybody who's listening and knows me knows that I am a psychologist. Spent many years in the field. I've read all the crap. All the bullshit. Is a car a reflection of a male's sense of sexuality? And sometimes in reverse. In other words, the less potent the male feels, the bigger car he wants. Maybe that's what produces those gigantic, those trucks on gigantic wheels. You know, they call them monster cars, monster trucks. I don't know. Most of it to me is bullshit, but it is true that the gestalt is different than the sum of the parts. Well, let's get down to some of the nitty-gritty of what Seth actually said. Now, what I'm going to do here is I'm going to jump directly into the Seth material and start pulling it out concept by concept, piece by piece, okay? And this is a good approach. It really is. I got to tell you, the first time I went through the Seth material, you know, you get kind of overwhelmed. So you need a kind of an organized manner of approaching it. There's an excellent website, and I'll find it here in a second. It's at GeoCities, and the person who owns the website took many quotes out of the Seth material, especially Seth Speaks, by the way, and put them up on a website. The actual, let me see if I got it here. Yeah, it's geocities.com/athens5484/quotes.htm. Eventually you'll be able to find it on my own website, but I'm not going to have it now. Not until all the stuff material is, until I'm done with it. Anyway, let's get to it. Number one on the list. Now this is a quote. Creation is infinite and is a direct result of the individual consciousnesses that make up the God gestalt. Ergo, God is constantly in a state of change and transformation. End quote. Okay. Right there, you start understanding pantheism. Not panentheism, but pantheism, because in panentheism, God doesn't change. God is static. In pantheism, God is constantly in a state of change and transformation. Now, when Seth says this, when Seth makes a statement, he could just as easily have substituted all of existence is constantly in a state of change and transformation. Are you starting to get the idea? Yeah. See, in panentheism, God does not change. God's a static entity that kind of like, just a hairline difference between him, it, her, whatever, and the guy in the big flowing robe, who is static and creates everything. Everything emanates from that thing, but that thing itself never changes. Only that which it creates changes. Not with Seth. Seth is saying, God is constantly in a state of change and transformation. And he's simply saying, everything that is, all that is constantly in a state of change and transformation. You might want to start, you know, some people love to take this material and come up with motivation, you know. Well, why? They ask why? I think you almost have to step outside of the Seth material if you're really going to try to answer that kind of question about the best I can come up with. And this really comes from conversations with God, you know, Neil Donald Walsh. And it's all about entertainment. Yeah. God is constantly in a state of change and transformation because if everything that is wasn't, we'd be bored shitless. I mean, think about it. If nothing ever changed. I guess, in a way, I have to say, there's also a self-awareness of all that is. Boy, you know, the second that I say that, you know, it brings on the concept of panentheism. No. I am not referring to that. I'm simply saying that there is a connection between everything. And that everything at some point must have had a realization of absolute boredom. I mean, how else can I put it? So it expands out and goes through a process in which change, constant change and transformation is possible. And when I say constant, I mean absolutely constant in terms of nanoseconds. It is constantly changing at the infinite level. For the purpose of entertainment. What else could it possibly be? You're never going to get bored. Ever. You will never, think about it, you will never be bored. You know how sometimes you sit home on a Saturday afternoon, you didn't make any real plans, it's kind of crappy weather outside, you start twiddling your thumbs, you put on a pot of coffee, and you start saying things like, geez, yeah, I'm kind of a little bored. I've got nothing to do. You don't really feel like doing the chores. There is something to do. That sense of boredom, you know, like, oh, gee, I wish I had something kind of interesting to do. Hey, that's what existence is all about. Something very interesting to do. Unfortunately, folks, we made a slight mistake. And that mistake was the ego. Not only are we in a constant state of change, in terms of existence itself, we can't get out of the physical self, which is constantly changing. We can't get out of the concept of the reality of it. We can't let it go. Seth also said, quote, Christ, who, listen to this, who still exists, is a highly evolved entity who has existence in many systems of reality. However, Christ has the same relationship to God that all other individuals do, i.e., he is part of God, end quote. What does he mean? Well, I think that one of the most fascinating parts to me is that is the part it says where he says Christ who still exists. Christ did not disappear. And he says Christ is a highly evolved entity. Highly evolved. No. I am not as highly evolved as Christ, and neither are anyone who's listening to this show. But one thing that we all have in common with that Christ entity is that we are all part of God. Christ didn't have more of a part than you. In other words, he didn't have a bigger part of the God thing. No. It's all God stuff. Now, isn't that interesting? Because when you look at it, you have to immediately come up with the conclusion of, well, if quantity doesn't account for evolving, then what does? In other words, you don't have to have more God in you to evolve. The issue here is, what then produces the evolving spiritual self? I shouldn't use the word spiritual self, the evolving self, the evolving self-awareness. And I think the key for evolving is coming to recognize that you do have an ego that prevents you from evolving. I'm guessing here, but the best I can come up with is that the personage, Christ, was well aware of the ego and made every attempt to move beyond the ego that kept him encapsulated. Now, this is where it gets really fascinating, because Seth starts talking about, will the real Christ please stand up? Well, at the time of Christ, this is a quote, at the time of Christ, I'm quoting here, recognize the word time is used by Seth, which would be approximately 2,000 years ago or so. The Christ entity incarnated as three individuals. One was John the Baptist. Two was Jesus of Nazareth, and three was Paul of Tarsus. So what Seth is, end quote, what Seth is saying is that the Christ figure that we recognize historically was really three different people. Three different people made up that personage. Quote, each was to some degree aware of his role in founding a new religion. End quote. Now, this is all with the exception that Paul was not aware of his role until after his conversion to Christianity. John the Baptist and Jesus apparently were both aware of their mission on this planet, their mission in this reincarnation. I guess from day one, you know, from whenever they can recognize their own memory. I don't know, age 4 or 5, whatever. But that actually did not happen to Paul until after his conversion to Christianity. So, is there one Christ according to Seth? No. No. And Seth also states that Jesus of Nazareth was not crucified. And why not? Because Seth says it's just plain not in the nature of enlightened individuals to sacrifice themselves. Now, isn't that a kick in the ass? Everybody wants to walk around saying, yeah, throw yourself in front of the moving car on behalf of society. No. According to Seth, enlightened individuals just plain do not sacrifice themselves. It's not in their nature. This actually brings up something from a fictional character. If you ever get a chance, do read the book Stranger in a Strange Land, because you will find, quote, the individual sacrificing himself on behalf of others. But, you know, it's fictional work, and it's kind of a takeoff on the Jesus, on the typical or traditional Jesus character. In other words, Jesus sacrificed himself on behalf of all the people in the world. Well, according to Seth, it's not in the nature of enlightened individuals to sacrifice themselves. Well, did anybody actually get crucified? Let me quote this. Quote, rather, a willing and deluded surrogate who believed himself to be the Messiah was substituted in Jesus' place, and it was this surrogate whom Judas betrayed and who was then crucified. Whoa! According to Seth, Jesus of Nazareth was not crucified. It was a deluded surrogate. In other words, the guy didn't know. The guy believed that he was the Messiah. How that came about, I don't know. I've got this concept in my own head that suggests, well, maybe John the Baptist and Jesus had this guy cornered and started convincing him that he was, in fact, the Messiah so that he would get crucified rather than Jesus. I mean, you could easily conjure up a lot of manipulation going on. However, according to Seth, Jesus was then able to be resurrected because he had not actually died. Seth said that the crucifixion of Jesus did occur as a shared psychic event, but it did not occur as a physical event. You know, I've stared at that sentence many times, a shared psychic event. And I'm not really sure of what it means, other than I try to conjure up a feeling tone inside myself of that event, the event of the crucifixion. But I tell you the truth, I don't get too far with it. I really don't. However, Seth is adamant about stating that Jesus of Nazareth did not get crucified. That whole area really intrigued me. And I actually spent some time looking on the net for, was there any kind of real evidence that we could look at besides the words of Seth? Yeah, you know, if you search around on the net, you are in fact going to find people who will show you, if you're willing to believe it, evidence would suggest that it did not happen. Jesus of Nazareth never did get crucified, and the appearance of resurrection was because he didn't actually die. Now, this, of course, runs counter to all the Christian religions. I mean, you know, where would... where would Christmas be if not for Jesus? How about Easter? I mean, there's a tough one for the Christians to get through. Well, if you go by Seth, there was a crucifixion, but it was not Jesus of Nazareth, and Judas betrayed the surrogate. I don't know, a stand-in for Jesus. I don't know how else to say it. Now, a little further down in the Seth material, you come to find out that Seth suggests that Paul is going to reincarnate in the 21st century. Well, that's now. However, the entire return of Paul won't actually be completed until the year 2075. So that leaves us all out of it. I'm certainly not going to be around for that long. Why is Paul reincarnating? Well, Seth would have you believe that Christianity set itself on a wrong course. But somehow it went awry. Things didn't quite work out as John the Baptist and Jesus and Paul had wanted it to. You know, things got kind of screwed up. So Paul supposedly will reincarnate to set things right. However, this is where it gets fascinating. Seth also suggests that while Paul will not refer to himself as Christ, he will be viewed as the Antichrist. Well, that kind of makes sense, because if this is going to happen, as predicted by Seth, then why is Paul here? Well, he's here to get rid of traditional Christianity, along with other organized religions. Yeah! I certainly could applaud that, but it's not for me, it's from Seth. Paul's going to be known as a psychic. And his job is to get Christianity on the right road, straighten it out, so to speak. Now, by the time Paul actually does reincarnate, Christianity itself is actually going to be worse than it is now. But he's going to form a new system. Now, the quote from Seth is, a new system of thought when the world is sorely in need of one, end quote. Well, I mean, to me, it seems like we're in sorely need of one now. I mean, how much more do we have to go through? But I guess some waiting is to occur. Now, I'm guessing on that one. This is the 21st century, and he doesn't say when he's going to reincarnate. He simply says it will be substantially completed by the year 2075. In other words, it could mean that I might be, in fact, around in terms of the reincarnation, the beginning reincarnation part, but the actual fixing of Christianity itself will not be completed until the year 2075. Well, I'm sure not going to be around that long. And most of you out there, well, all of you out there, unless something amazing happens, are not going to be around in the year 2075. However, maybe I shouldn't say that. You know, we do create our own reality. And some of us might actually catch on, how to let go of the ego and do some rather amazing things. It could happen. It could happen. Well, we're almost out of time. One of the best direct quotes, and it's what I'm going to leave it with for this afternoon, and this is from Seth. You create your reality according to your beliefs and expectations. Therefore, you should examine these carefully. If you do not like some aspect of your world, then examine your own expectations. Next week, I'm going to kind of try to focus in on that a little more, and I'm going to toss in some of my own thoughts about that whole aspect of beliefs and expectations. It's got to do with your assumptions regarding your existence and the universe itself. I've talked about it before, and I'm going to bring it right in to that very first part. So examine your own expectations. Thank you for listening. It's been great being here. I love doing this show. I love the Seth material. I wish all of you a wonderful day. That's a wrap, Don.